Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, the Olympics, Dave.
Oh, is it the Olympics?
It is the Olympics. And look, I want to hit you with a fact that I only discovered yesterday. Do you know the names of, I know he's not in this current Olympics, but do you know the names of Usain Bolt's children?
Oh, no, I don't, but I'm looking forward
to hearing.
Usain Bolt,
since the last Olympics, has had three children. One of them is a daughter, whose name is Olympia Lightning Bolt.
I was just about to guess in a facetious manner. Yeah. I said, surely they're not called Lightning.
Well, hold your fire, because it gets worse. I assume she's called Olympia, but her second name is Lightning. But his twin sons, right, one of them is called Saint Leo, and the other is called, and this is his first name, do you want to guess?
Go on.
Thunder. That's his first name.
Dear God.
So can you imagine those happy days of school ahead? How long will it be before he changes his name to Derek or Colin?
Keith Richards' daughter changed her name from Dandelion to Angela, didn't she?
She did.
Child was called God, wasn't it?
God.
And retreated to the more to conservative China, I think, you know. So,
Your Majesty Jackson ever changed his name? I don't think he has.
I mean, not.
Your Majesty probably goes to the kind of school where absolutely everybody's got a pop star father and a ridiculous name.
God.
You've got to admit that's sensational, don't you think? Thunderbolt.
So, oh, my God. Can you imagine? I'm sorry about my name. My father's an egomaniac.
That's the only possible
explanation.
Determined to make my life utterly miserable.
Do you know what struck me about the Olympics, which is something I've only had a very kind of glancing acquaintance with this time around, is that, do you know what's the key word for Olympics commentary nowadays? It's not speed, it's not strength, and it's emotion. They say this all the time. There was lots of emotion on display. And when they talk about emotion, they're not talking about the full range of human emotions, you know, joy, jealousy, sadness, tension, whatever. They're talking about one thing or one thing only, which is the thing that gets all TV producers out of bed in the morning, but particularly TV sports producers out of bed in the morning. And that is the possibility that they might be able to elicit tears.
Oh, entirely.
Tears is what TV sports coverage is all about nowadays. Will people cry? Can we get people to cry? Can we
put them in great television?
It makes great television.
It makes amazing television. And it makes great kind of media generally. You know, if you just, the word tears, the promise of tears telegraphs intense, supercharged emotional moments, which are newsworthy, aren't they? You want to investigate.
Absolutely.
Keir Starmer cries when interviewed by Piers Morgan. I've got to spool through to that bit. You know, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous because I suppose it's similar to The X Factor, which I note has finally been put out of its misery this week, hasn't it? Simon Cowell says I'm not going to do it any longer. And, you know, that similarly is not about music. That's also about tears.
Completely.
Tears are not enough. Oh, yes, they are for television. Oh, they are.
Well, you won't watch this, I'm sure, but there's a program called Repair Shop. Have you heard of that?
Repair Shop is a program where
it's been going for a while, and people used to kind of bring along broken Victorian chairs and get them kind of restored, you know. It's now changed to a system where it's all about that shot where the little toy, the little musical box that grandfather gave me 70 years ago has just been mended and plays its little tinkling tune. And then you get the close-up of the person weeping on here, which is understandable, but the whole thing is now engineered towards, that's the punchline. There's no tears, you feel shortchanged. You
know? It's really interesting, isn't it? About the only show on television that doesn't have tears is Antiques Roadshow, you know, so where people are told that they're, the heirloom that great-grandfather carried through the Crimean War.
They put on a brave face. They're waving, wearing like cartoon characters. They're wearing a wavy line for a smile.
The other program that absolutely has to have tears is Who Do You Think You Are? The analogy thing. There is always something where somebody it doesn't matter whether she suffered through, you know, Buchenwald or whatever, or had a bit of a tough time in the West Road of Yorkshire. You know, there will always be some opportunity for tears, and they will hold that shot long enough for somebody to cry, because people being interviewed sort of know it's expected of
them. They do.
A time. So they do it.
But the Olympics, I mean, part of it is, and I kind of slightly sympathize with this, the Olympics is only every 4 years, or in this case, every 5 years, actually. And so it's not like football where you're playing twice a week. You know, this is the event
this
you've
is your
been
chance.
Building up
no,
to.
True,
and
true.
Can you imagine what it'd be like to get there and be kind of cancelled because you've been pinged because somebody in the camp had COVID or what? You know what I mean? I mean, it must be absolutely heartbreaking.
I think
the real star has been Helen Glover, who since the last Olympics has had three children. She's the one who came fourth, couldn't get the bronze medal. No tears from her. Whereas now anybody else who wins hurls themselves bawling onto the track and appears to be in some kind of agony, but actually it's a form of ecstasy, isn't it? So it's quite hard to celebrate with them because they appear to be distraught. You know?
Very, very. But the same thing applies with all sport nowadays, doesn't it?
Whereas,
if you go and look on YouTube at the old clip of Jim Laker getting all the Australian wickets during that test match in the 50s. And he kind of, you know, after he's got the final wicket, you know, the rest of the team just kind of walk up to him and just tap him lightly on the shoulder. That's the extent of the drama about it.
Yeah, don't have to high-five him in between each one. Doesn't have to get a knighted.
Not necessary at all.
I know.
Anyway,
so
talking of great emotional occasions, is it 50 years ago, and is it this very day?
It's today. You're talking about Bangladesh. Today, the concert for Bangladesh.
The concert for Bangladesh was on a Sunday. Today. Was on Sunday, August the 1st.
Yeah, it
was. 1971. So it's extraordinary. So the war in Bangladesh had only started in March, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, and followed the cyclone, didn't it? There was a cyclone where a lot of people killed, and then the refugees, the war had started, and all the various people were leaving Bangladesh. And I think George was over producing a soundtrack album for Ravi Shankar, and Ravi Shankar just convinced him that something ought to be done.
Well, Ravi Shankar was initially going to do a show, wasn't he? And George said, "I'll do it with you.
Bring along some of my heavy friends."
At which point it stops being a Ravi Shankar recital at Carnegie Hall or whatever and starts becoming something bigger. Although something bigger that nobody had any experience of doing that kind of thing.
There's never been
anything like that before.
I was reading some stuff about it yesterday. And what amazed me was, because, as you said, the number of obstacles that George Harrison had to overcome, and there was no precedent for it. I mean, firstly, there wasn't any email. All of that was done, well, like Bob Geldof, it's all done by the telephone. On the phone, 12 hours a day, ringing up all his mates. Paul McCartney refused to participate because Alan Klein was involved. Mm. Remember that? John Lennon said he would participate, but only if Yoko Ono could be on stage.
At which point, George went quiet.
And actually, I watched it on Sky Arts last night. Do you know what was on Sky Arts last night?
Was the
Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus.
Oh, right, okay.
Have you ever seen it?
Yes, go on.
The bit in that where Yoko comes on. And, you know, it's Dirty Mac, with Eric Clapton, you know, he does her kind of 10 minutes of wailing. And you just think, that's what George would have seen. That's what George would think. We do not need this at this concert. So that was probably quite an easy one to sidestep. Then he had the problem with Eric Clapton, who wanted to come but was so addicted to heroin that he didn't think he was going to be well enough to play. And even when he did come, he had to be met with a big package of smack at the airport or something, I think. Ed Davis had been rehearsed as a kind of as a backup.
Peter Frampton was brought in as the backup. Peter Frampton
and Jesse Ed Davis, I think two of them.
Jesse Ed Davis ended up playing, I think. Did Peter Frampton play?
No, he didn't.
So you're on the subs bench, Peter.
Not required.
Anyway, go on.
And then he borrowed the stage that was already set up in Madison Square Garden from Stephen Stills made some deal they'd carry on the stage, and then never thanked Stephen Stills or asked him to play. So Stephen Stills turned up at the concert, spent the entire time rattling around in Ringo Starr's dressing room, drunk and just being belligerent. So that's not going to help, is it? The basic group, which I think was Leon Russell and Klaus Voormann and Ringo and Jim Keltner, kind of, they came together fairly early. But the rest only arrived just before the concert. And even then, Ringo and Leon Russell, I think, and Billy Preston only arrived just before the rehearsals. So it was all hanging in the breeze, wasn't it? And Dylan went to the rehearsals, took one look at it and said, I'm not going to do this. Do you remember? He said, I think I've got a few things I have to do in New Jersey. I can't be there. And George Harrison was going, well, mate, you know, at least you've been out as a solo performer. I've been in a band. I've never been out on my own at the front. I'm not used to this. This isn't kind of my scene either. But, you know, you've got to help me out here. And then, actually, at the gig, he always claimed that he had a little set list written down. He said, after Here Comes the Sun, it says Bob, ? And when he looked into the wings, he had no idea whether Bob Dylan was going to be there or he wasn't. And when he came on, it was fairly instantly a triumph. And they go back to the hotel that night, and Dylan goes, this is fantastic. Let's do three shows, you know.
Well, they did two. They did two.
They did a matinee, didn't they?
50 years ago today, they did one at 2:30 in the afternoon, and then one at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening, which is extraordinary to think, you know, when people talk about these big shows nowadays.
Yeah.
The idea that you do it twice in the day is pretty remarkable. But the key thing about Bob Dylan at the concert for Bangladesh, as we've remarked upon many times, two key things. One, blue denim jacket.
Yep.
He turned up in the blue denim jacket.
Yeah.
Which everybody said, he's back to folk. And the other is he had the harmonica holder, you know, around his neck, you know, traditionally. So we've got Bob, the protesting Bob back. That's what everybody thought at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, they
did. What did he sing? Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall?
That's right.
What else did he do? I can't remember.
God,
yeah.
Forever Young, was it?
I don't think it would be Forever Young. That'd be later.
If Not For You, I don't know if that was used in the But yeah, they all thought it was the folk protest prophet back.
Yeah, and that was the picture of him at the concert of Bangladesh was used on the cover of what I think is still his best-selling record.
It was.
Which is Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits.
Greatest Hits.
Two, or whatever, which came out in 1971. Because that was the other connection with Bob Dylan and Concert for Bangladesh, is that Leon Russell had produced and played on his only recording of 1971, which was Watching the River Flow. So,
which is on that Greatest Hits record.
It's on that Greatest Hits. That's the only LP it's on. Yeah. So, you know, he'd worked with Leon Russell. And Leon Russell was the kind of... He was the musical director, really, as much as anything else. Of course, in the middle of it, it's hilarious if you see it now. Leon Russell does his party piece, which is the Coasters song, Young Blood.
That's right. That's
which
right.
is all about an underage girl. It is.
It's
all a bit of a laugh. You know what I mean? And, I don't know if they'll cut that out when they're doing the remastered version of it. I don't know. But it was, and of course, we only really saw this in Britain, you know, the following year, I suppose, when the film came out. Because it was only filmed by a miracle, wasn't it? They had three cameras or something like that. One of them didn't
work.
One
of them didn't work. That's another of the problems. One of them didn't work. I know.
You know,
because. But can you imagine that show if Dylan hadn't been there? Because he's the kind of emotional core of it.
He is.
You think? You know, and also he's the guy who really established. He's the story. And he established that idea, the connection between pop music as a kind of political weapon that could bring about some kind of change. You know, Hattie Carroll and Oxford Town, Emmett Till and, you know, Hollis Brown, all those songs he'd written. And he, you know, he was the absolute heart and soul of it. And the other thing I think is it's sort of, to me, it seemed to be the beginning of that idea of, not kind of nostalgia, but people realizing the power of their greatest hits. Because he just goes and plays his most popular songs.
Absolutely.
He doesn't do anything idiotic, like try and play something recent.
No.
It's all big songs. And before that,
everybody had done basically
our new album. So I think that was a major change.
No, it was, definitely. And it's
fantastic
of it. It's still the template for all kind of big fundraising, consciousness-raising musical events. To this day, 50 years ago, this very day.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
People are often asking how they can help us. Three ways you can help us. One is if you're watching this on YouTube, if that happens to be the case, make sure you subscribe to this channel. If you're listening to it as a podcast, make sure you leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or wherever. But all those things really help. And if you really want to help, you can become a supporter on Patreon and you find out how to do that. And there are many different levels at which you could do that. You go to patreon.com/word in your ear and you can play your part in helping us do this very important work that we're continue to be involved in.
Work of national importance.
A work of national unimportance, possibly. but we had a particular pleasure in the last week to welcome Edgar Wright as our guest in Word of Your Attic, where he was showing us all his old records that his mum and dad we'd inherited from his mum and dad, and talking about his prized collection of KTEL compilations,
Gronko compilations,
but also talking about his new film about Sparks, the brothers Sparks, which just came out last week, and we saw last week, didn't we, Mark?
Fantastic. Also, can I just say, what a fabulously affable geezer he is. It's struck me, we were having this conversation afterwards, that film directors have to be like that, don't they? They have to be personable and friendly.
They have to be people.
And charming. People. And people, because that's what they do all day, is they're trying to persuade a lot of people to do something that they want them to do that they might not necessarily want to do. And so it's all about just being diplomatic. You know, he's an absolutely terrific guy. And I thought it was really interesting because neither you or I are particularly involved with Sparks, are we? I mean, I've been aware of them all my life and I've listened to their records. I never felt any kind of emotional attachment to them. But what a fantastic story. I mean,
it's extraordinary.
Extraordinary story. I mean, they're together anyway, obviously, in life because they're brothers. But by the age of about 16, 17 in 66, they formed groups. And they're still in a group together now, you know. And the idea that those two guys have spent so much time, even now, they get to the studio, don't they, and work next door to each other, just literally sitting next to each other at their desks with their screens, writing songs, that kind of telepathy that they've developed is absolutely extraordinary. And also that there's never been a moment of enormous success that's overshadowed everything else.
I think that's a key thing.
They've had their ups and downs. I mean, lots of ups and downs. They've been reinvented at least twice. There's a bit where they come back with Giorgio Moroder with a completely different sound. But because they've never had any great moment in the sun, you've got nothing to kind of compare it to. And they've just kept going. 25 albums in 50 years.
It is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? As somebody says near the end of the film, I mean, there's lots of talking heads in the film. There's lots of, you know, famous fans. But somebody makes the point later in the film, which I think is a really good point, that the most groups have their kind of purple patch.
Yeah.
And, you know, they lead up to it and then they lead away from it. And they didn't really. They just kept going. And, you know, they've had periods when they've got in the charts and then periods when they didn't. And then again, but it's as if one era of success had no connection with a later era of success. It's as if a bunch of different people came along and liked them for different reasons.
Absolutely.
10 years later, you know what I mean? So it doesn't link up apart from the fact that it's happened to the same two guys. And I was very struck by the fact that somebody said that who toured with them, who was in their touring band, I think, in the late 70s when they were kind of glam rock sensations almost in the UK with This Town Ain't Big Enough and so forth. They said that that after shows, Russell would meet the fans and me in the bar and so forth. Ron would just go straight to his room and just continue working on music.
Yeah.
And that's clearly been one of the main things all the way through, that there's never been a writer's block period or anything like that.
No, never.
There's never been, nobody ever needed to go away and have some ideas.
And they're completely driven.
They just had those ideas all the time.
Yeah, they, you know, very early, and when they're teenagers, I think Russell's making kind of fake kind of pastiche French art movies on a little handheld camera. You know, they're just driven by this idea of kind of creativity. And I thought it was really, really impressive. Also, another thing that struck me was the idea of the humour. I mean, they are really funny. You know, and there are lots of musicians who are really funny, but their music is not intrinsically funny. You know, the Beatles were fantastic, fantastically humorous and likable, amusing characters. And apart from You Know My Name, Look Up the Number, they didn't do anything that was deliberately, overtly funny. Whereas Sparks, you know, the song, that song, I Married Myself, I'm Very Happy Together. There's a song called Throw Away and Get a New One, which is just like everything else in the world, time wreaks havoc on every girl. What to do? What do you do? What do you do? You throw away and get a new one. I mean, that can be obviously misunderstood, but that's a humorous song, you know. Yeah. And they produce genuinely funny songs and were genuinely funny in interviews. You know, they're on these chat shows, you get clips on them. There's one bit where their record company won't pay for a video. So they cut out a little cardboard screen of a TV and go on this chat show. And Russell sings the new song through this cutout TV just to kind of to get a kind of cheap video moment, you know. And they do all these kind of daft dances and they talk in characters and they just, there's just something really genuinely funny about it. And it made me think that they're the most commercially successful, genuinely funny and humorous group that there's ever been. Because there are humorous bands, aren't there? You know, it's the Bonzos or whatever.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Weird Al Yankovic. But humor is a very divisive thing. You might like the music, but not necessarily like the humor.
Two interesting things about the film as a kind of pop documentary. There's two things that don't happen in the film that happen in 99% of pop documentaries. There is no one great central tragic moment. You know what I mean? There's no point at which somebody leaves or somebody dies or whatever. It simply doesn't happen. And the other thing, which at the time I thought, I feel a bit shortchanged. And then I thought about it afterwards, and I think, no, it's fine, is you don't learn anything about their personal lives, do you?
No, nothing at all.
Anything. You don't meet their significant others or see their children or grandchildren, right? I don't know if they have them.
You don't even know if they have any. There's tiny little bits of footage of them when they're kids from their quite posh background, winning kind of talent contests, dressed in pink tuxedos, being sports jocks at school, to make them surfing. But no, you discover nothing about them at all. It's completely...
At the end, did you notice who the film's dedicated to? To their mum and dad, which I thought was very sweet. That was the final bit. You know,
so sweet.
Well, father died quite young, didn't he? And, you know, and the other thing, there's a wonderful clip of them. You could see them in an audience at a Beatles show.
Oh, yeah, the camera pans around and there they are. That's right.
And was it in Las Vegas, that show? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was, I think.
But anyway, Russell is talking about it. He said, our mother drove us to Las Vegas in her, I can't remember what car it was, a knackered old car. So it wasn't easy. It was a long drive. She took the two of us. She waited for us. She took us back. That's a mom.
They're still thanking her today.
Absolutely. It's a very sweet thing to say.
Nice point, I think, about them also looking like they invented that template for the synthesizer duo. Because when you saw all the interviews of people like Vince Clarke, he was saying, that's it. You know, there's Ron, the kind of poker-faced, kind of utterly unexpressive keyboard player. And then the very flamboyant theatrical frontman. And, you know, you look at, Pet Shop Boys. And you look at
Erasure.
Yazoo Erasure, exactly. And you just think there's a lot of truth in that. Incredibly influential. Also, I never knew how they got their name. Did you know that?
I didn't know what they were called.
Half Nelson. You need a new name. You know, what about the Sparks Brothers? That was the pun on the Marx Brothers, you know, which is in fact the name of this movie. And they didn't like that. They just thought, well, we'll just call it Sparks. You know, fair enough. Well, I never knew that.
Another thing, we'll throw this in for the benefit of anybody who's actually has got pictures on this and watching this. What's the connection between Sparks and this album that I'm holding up here, Mark? Tell everybody.
Well, it's Miss Christine, isn't it, from the GTOs, isn't that right?
That is Frank Zappa's Hot Rats. The woman on the cover of Frank Zappa's Hot Rats is Miss Christine from the GTOs.
And she was
the girlfriend of Todd Rundgren and also, later, Russell Mayall. Yeah. And so she was the two that she was the person who connected them with Todd Rundgren,
who produced their first album. Who kind of the without whom there would be no Sparks.
Yeah, absolutely, without him there would be no Sparks.
Fantastic story. Really good film.
Particularly, obviously, if you're a Sparks fan, but even if you're not. So, moving on. Have you noticed this sad tale of Ryan Adams has been making appeals, crying in the wilderness on Instagram?
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, I did. He's sort of saying, my destiny is I'm going to be living in a basement in my sister's house. I can't make a living. But I mean, it's a complicated story, isn't it?
I'm not getting into the rights and wrongs of it. Here's the thing that interests me. You know, it was clearly some kind of misconduct, you know, of a sexual nature.
Yeah, there was.
Whatever.
I
don't think it's ever been to court or anything like this, you know, but clearly there was some very bad behavior. And he's been cast into the outer darkness to the extent that he can't get gigs. Well, obviously, in the last year, nobody's got gigs. Can't get a record deal. Probably can't get a publishing deal. I don't know. Here's my point that I think is interesting, that there have always been scandals in the past in show business, in popular music or whatever. There's been blacklists and so forth. But there's usually been somebody who would hire you in some shape or form.
But you can't do that now.
You can't do that.
You simply can't do that. I mean, I thought exactly the same thing because you think of, you know, I don't know, Jerry Lee Lewis or something.
Jerry Lee Lewis
married a
13-year-old
girl while being married to two other women or whatever. I know. And now, if you were to sign Ryan Adams, you would have the most humongous digital bricks thrown through your window, wouldn't you?
If you put him on your TV show hired him to do one gig or something.
Someone would engineer that your career was cancelled. It wouldn't be worth the risk on anybody's part.
You know, so you can kind of you can see how he might be despairing. You know,
but also it made me think that some musicians, it's possible that it might be a lot of musicians actually. That's all they can really do, and I don't mean that disparagingly because that's fantastic. But that's their skill. We've had this conversation on the podcast before. Steve Marriott, people like that. What else could they have done in life apart from be the people that they eventually were? And Ryan Adams is a good example of that, I think, you know, because he's faced with the idea of going off and trying to find some other form of employment. He's just thinking, I'm not equipped to do anything else. So it's
contrast that with somebody else who's sadly been in the news this week. Dusty Hill, the bass player from ZZ Top. Longest unchanged lineup of popular music, wasn't it? We worked out.
Yeah, it was. They formed in 69, didn't they? I think. Yeah,
something like that. 1969. Well, he sadly died the other day, and Dusty Hill did something remarkable in, I suppose, the late 70s. You know, so ZZ Top kind of had two careers. You know, one is the kind of great Texas boogie band and going on tour with, you know, Steers and Rattlesnakes and, you know, taking Texas on tour. And then their later reinvention as a kind of MTV favorite cartoon dance band. But in between the two, there was a bit of a hiatus where Frank Beard, who was the drummer, had a drink and drugs problem, really serious drink and drugs problem. So he took himself away to rehab, to clean up. And Billy Gibbons, who was the leader and the songwriter, Billy Gibbons is a bit of a Renaissance man. And I think he did the grand tour of Europe, you know, to see all the great galleries and architectural monuments and so forth. Dusty Hill, not really that kind of guy, was back home in Houston and thought, what am I going to do? What am I going to do for the next year?
And he got a job
at the airport because that's where all his mates worked. He got a job as a baggage handler at the airport. And I think points to Dusty Hill for doing that. That's absolutely
And points to Dusty Hill also because he's so identifiable. People would have seen him and thought, that's a member of ZZ Top, you know.
Well, I think at that stage, I don't think the beard's there. It's probably
maybe they
pre-beard.
Hadn't. Was it later?
It's slightly pre-beard. But I think that's a unique story, isn't it?
It is.
You know,
and the other unique thing about it is that his dying wish was that his guitar tech, should take his position in the group. Mm. And that's been agreed, isn't it? Which is
apparently
quite interesting.
So.
A new development in rock business strategy. You recommend your replacement. And it's really amazing.
Anyway, Dusty Hill, respect.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Okay, any other business? Where we're joined by Alex Gold, fresh from being a member of the Rolling Stones last night, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
You played a wedding as the Rolling Stones, not a wedding, a party, a 60th party as the Rolling Stones.
It was a 60th party, a joint 60th party that kind of wanted to be a festival. So it was a joint 60th party and it was set up. They rented a field, set up a huge like festival stage, got food trucks in. So you had a taco truck and a Lebanese food truck and a burger truck and a champagne bar, hay bales to sit on. It was bizarre. It was clearly a bit of cash floating.
Absolutely. Now you were saying you got a lift down with Ronnie Wood. So you are clearly playing latter day Rolling Stones. Does that include any Brian Jones Rolling Stones? Does Ronnie whip off his Ronnie wig and put on a blonde wig?
What happens is they'll do a set of early Stone stuff and they'll do a set of later Stone stuff and sort of merge Mick Taylor with Ronnie Wood. This time it was a quick whip round through everything. So an hour set and we did last time and, all over now and all that kind of stuff. And then went straight into the later stuff. But I step in with this Rolling Stones tribute quite often. And I've basically done the rounds with each member of the band. The only person I haven't played is Mick. It's bizarre.
You've been each member of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Do you have to dress as them each time?
Huh?
Do you have to dress up as them each time?
Yeah. Well, it's broadly the same, for me, really, because the only different costume really is Brian Jones, where I have to wear a blonde wig and a stripy jumper.
Got to have some cord hipster trousers. That's what you need.
Absolutely. But I discovered something really weird, and that's that you assume that because Keith Richards, you feel like Keith Richards was drunk all the time, and because his guitar riffs are not fast and they sound quite simple, it's really easy to play. But the thing with Keith Richards is his riffs are not easy to play because all his feel was completely unique. He had a style that's really hard to nail down. And you sort of forget that Keith Richards actually played the guitar. You kind of think of him as someone who just drank wine and looked cool.
That's so true. You just forget these people are musicians. They just become gigantic cartoon figures.
Yeah.
Waving a bottle of Jack Daniels and just talking like that. Like the Stella Street caricatures. Do you remember they had the corner shop?
You seen the date on these baked beans?
That's right. Yeah, it's well past its sell-by date. That's right,
So, okay, well, that's Alex as a member of the Rolling Stones. We've got some questions from people out there.
Oh, hurrah.
Joe says, why do we have World Cup songs but not Olympic Games songs?
Oh, well, that's obvious, because the Olympic Games is the United Kingdom and the World Cup is England, Scotland.
But we don't have England World Cup songs anymore, do we?
The tradition was that we did, but does anybody feel strongly enough about the United Kingdom to have a song about the United Kingdom? I'm not sure they do. I think it's really, if it's England, it's kind of England versus Scotland or whatever.
But isn't it quite hard to write a rousing chorus around discus or swimming? Swimming.
Yes. Have a verse about BMX and all that kind of stuff. Duncan wants to know, what was the name of the Philip Glass album that I mentioned in the last episode? It was Mishima. It was the soundtrack to the film about Mishima. Ian Martin says, what do we do about missing B-sides or remixes that get lopped off reissues and only exist in their old disintegrating format? And I presume there he's talking about vinyl or singles and so forth. He says, isn't good stuff being lost? I mean, can I just leap in and then respond?
Yeah, go on.
Because I think it'd be a good idea if stuff was lost. Because when stuff's lost, it becomes magical in a way that, nowadays, absolutely everything's available and available in the easiest possible way. And the more easily available it is, the less mystique it has. So what's wrong with going out and finding stuff? And it might take you years to track down the B-side or something. Wouldn't that be better if it did? What do you think?
Yeah, it would. Surely it would. Because it's just the effort put into discovery means that you get enormous amount of pleasure out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually finding out. If you, it's funny, you become, you know, if you just click on something and Google it, you so often can't even be bothered to hear it all the way through because
this
you
is it.
You can go and see something else.
Which
but leads, a physical leads, object. Yeah.
Leads to the next question, actually, which comes from Poppies from a Tray. He says, can you ever have the same relationship with an album that you have only streamed or downloaded that you had with one you had as a physical product?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, isn't that something to do with age as well? That you're saying, because I know exactly what he means, and the fiercely close relationship I have with certain records is partly with the fact that I first heard them when I was 16 or 17. And they meant an enormous amount to me. They were a soundtrack to my life. So that's a good question. Can you ever feel as strongly about something that you discover now that you discovered when you
well,
were...
Well, I don't think you can.
I don't know.
I don't think you can feel as strongly about something that is not a physical object that you can hold in your hand.
It's part of the...
I don't think you feel as strongly about a film because you don't hold it as your hand in your hand as you feel about a book because you hold it in your hand. Simple as that. There it is.
Yeah.
There's that thing. I can carry it around with me. I could take it somewhere. It's mine.
And the way you listen to it.
Film is not yours. You've gone to see it.
And the little window through which you enter it, the cover. I used to sit and read parts of the sleeve notes at exactly the same moment during certain songs. I had a whole system for the way I kind of listened to that music. And I don't know. You just, you develop an incredibly fierce bond, don't you?
Yeah. We're kind of designed to respond to things that we can touch. I mean, that's what we are as human beings. And
yeah,
you can't do that with streaming. You know, you could obviously like something, but
it's not yours.
Form a bond with
it's
it.
Not yours.
Yeah.
That's the thing. The thing about
physically,
you
can't, trouble.
You know, if you loved a record, you owned it. That was the definition of your loving it. That you gone and expressed your love in.
And you invested
in whatever it was.
You invested money and time in it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, a theatrical, a play will never be the same thing. A film will never be the same thing. A book can be. You know, an art exhibition, you don't feel the same about that. But a record, you did because you owned it. And if you rent it, which is effectively what you're doing in streaming, you can't feel the same way. You might like the music. That's fine. Jack wants to know, will the live music scene ever recover to pre-COVID levels? Alex, you're our man out in the live scene.
Yes.
What do you think? You think it will? Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of pent-up demand. People want to see live music because they've been denied it for so long. And I don't think streaming is going away anytime soon. I think that'll be added to the general pot of things that people can experience. But I don't think that people's desire to be in a room with an artist they love has diminished one iota during. In fact, I would say it's become stronger.
Not even in a stadium.
I don't think so. I think when it comes down to the opportunity to be able to buy a ticket to see, you know, the Rolling Stones or, you know, whoever your favorite artist is, in a big event scenario where there's 10,000 people celebrating your favorite song with you. I mean, who could turn that down, really?
Mark Say wants to know, is there ever a point in a percussionist who isn't the drummer? I think it's an interesting question. And Keith, on Twitter, actually, when I posted this last night, Keith Ansley responded, said, yes, there is a point. Ray Cooper is a prime example. Oh, fair enough. I was going to add, I think we talked about this before, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. The guy who played the triangle in Marvin Gaye's What's Going On is as important as any other musician on that record.
They got a guy in specifically to play the triangle. They didn't just get the drummer to do it.
No, it's a triangle player. He died not long ago. I've forgotten his name. Yeah, it's really significant thing there. And actually, he used to play, you know, all the loads of classic Motown records from the 60s. What was the distinctive instrument on loads of those? It was the tambourine. You know, because you could always hear the tambourine. It cut through everything. Tambourine. And also, it had that association with the church, which is clearly a huge part of the kind of...
What about Soul Sacrifice by Santana at Woodstock? Can you imagine that without the percussionists? Because there are two percussionists as well as the drummer. So they're absolutely integral to the whole thing, aren't they?
I think they are. And there's that great guy there. Was it Victor Feldman, the great British musician who ended up in Hollywood and played on loads of Steely Dan records and so forth? And these are the guys they used to you know, people would, they were the first call percussion players, you know, they were really important what they added to the sound. So I think we're saying, yes, there is a point.
We are.
For a percussionist who isn't the drummer. And what else have we got here? I'm whizzing through these.
There's a question about bands that you didn't like when you were young and you like now. I can't remember who it was from. Interesting.
Okay, go on. Have you got an example?
Well, I suppose mine would be Fairport Convention, who I never kind of got. I kind of used up all my folk rock with Steel I Span with Pentangle and completely overlooked them. And now, of course, realise that they were far, far and away superior. And magnificent. Also, Tom Petty, I thought was kind of smug and self-satisfied, and he became, maybe he changed, you know, maybe I changed.
He maybe just became you changed.
Soulful, maybe we changed. And just later, Tom Petty's absolutely.
Because I suppose that is the great point about music, isn't it? Generally, you enjoy it when you know, it kind of comes to you when you're ready for it.
Yeah.
There's no point going to chase it, you know. It'll happen to you one day.
Yeah, yeah.
One day you'll be at a stage of life, or you'll just have heard, your ears will be tuned a certain way. You'd hear something and you think, no, I get it now. And there's no point going to chase it. You know, it's quite a few questions are always, you know, what should I be listening to and all that kind of stuff. We all say the same thing. You should be listening to whatever you feel like listening to.
Yeah, it's like Roxy music. I didn't like Roxy music at all because I was kind of very, I had this thing about pretension. When I was that age, when that record came out. And somebody made a really good point. I think it's Paul Morley on that Sparks movie we were talking about. He said that Bob Harris, they had them on Old Grey Whistle Test, which footage has been lost for some reason. I wonder what happened to that.
Which is amazing. That's amazing.
Because I was thinking they must show this. It doesn't appear.
They don't lose much.
My God, what a thing to lose, because they had them on very, very early. And Paul Morley says something like, well, anything that Bob Harris said he didn't like was a massive endorsement for me, And I suppose I was probably more in the Bob Harris camp.
Well,
I was kind of thinking they're pretentious, you know.
And Bob only expressed his disapproval a couple of times, actually. He did it with the New York Dolls.
Rock. Yeah, I know.
So Kevin Walsh says, have you read any good books this summer? I've got great recommendations from us over the years. I'm going to throw in two written by the same author, actually, Kevin. One will be in paperback, one's probably still in hardback. John Preston has written two terrific non-fiction books about great kind of British scandals, I suppose. The one is a very English scandal, the one about Jeremy Thorpe, from which the Hugh Grant drama was on which the Hugh Grant drama was based, which was a fantastic TV program, but it's a better book. And he's subsequently written a book about Robert Maxwell, which I think is called Fall, and which I heartily recommend both of those if you're looking for something to read on holiday. Anybody got a book they like to recommend similarly?
God, well, not a recent one, but the one I always recommend for anybody going to a beach is Summer Lightning by P.G. Woodhouse. I'm sorry, I just got to throw it in. You
can't go wrong.
Possibly beat it. It's just gorgeous. The old crumbling country pile, the pig competition, the staff. It's marvellous. It's fantastic. Goes well with a cocktail.
One book I always recommend to people, although it will make them weep, is The Book Thief, which is a fictional story about a friendship in wartime Leipzig and kind of, I suppose, the war from the perspective of, of regular German people who didn't want to be a part of it. And it's a beautiful...
The Book Thief. Book. Who's that by? No, I've never come across that.
The author is, you know, weirdly.
All right. I'm sure people can look at
someone, but it's really, really good. But you will cry buckets.
All right, there you go. The Book Thief. The Book Thief, Summer Lightning, and the John Preston book about Robert Maxwell. You can't go wrong with any of them. Have we got anything to add this week? Have we got anything further to say? What else have we been doing? We've recorded A Word in Your Attic with Robin Ince. I don't think that's gone up yet, has it?
Not just yet. It will be in the next day or so.
It will be going up in the next day or so.
We got the Edgar Rice one we were talking about, which is Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Edgar Winter. Edgar Broughton.
Marvellous.
Edgar's in Rock. That's a short list, isn't it? Edgar Winter, Edgar Broughton, Edgar Wright, We call him. We'll borrow him for this.
We will
benefit of this exercise. I can't think of any more.
I think that's the sum total of Edgar.
That's the sum total of Edgar.
It's not a very rock and roll name, is it?
No. And so also we've got coming up in the next few weeks, we're going to be talking to Eamon Ford about his fantastic book about
God, it's brilliant
about rock and roll after death, I suppose, and the kind of the wills and the estates and the afterlife and the exploitation of catalogues. The whole world opens up. It's
the opening chapter alone.
Brick-like tome.
Yeah, the opening chapter about what started the whose death started the kind of nostalgia market is really, really extraordinary. And that's the late 50s.
And if you haven't made a will, you'll read this book and the first thing you'll do is go off and make a will. Because when you read what happened to Prince of the estate of Prince after he didn't make a will, it's absolutely hair-raising. Anyway, we're going to be talking to him. We're going to be talking to Tony Fletcher coming up sometime in the next few weeks and lots of other stuff. And if you want to know more about it, go, as I say, if you want to get involved in supporting this, patreon.com/wordinyourear. We'll see you on the other side.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.